Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's tee this up. Bernie Sanders won the New Hampshire primary last night.
And let me say tonight that this victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
But Pete Buttigieg leads in the delegate count and last night took aim at Sanders' progressive agenda, including Medicare for All.
Americans want the freedom to make choices for themselves on health care or on any other issue, not to have Washington decide for them. And a politics of my way or the highway is a road to reelecting Donald Trump.
Third, the bronze, but a big victory went to Amy Klobuchar.
Hello, America. I'm Amy Klobuchar, and I will beat Donald Trump.
Short and sweet. Well, the previous top candidates, Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden, came in a dismal fourth and fifth, but vowed to press on.
Let's bring in our political strategist, Bill Press, a Democrat. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Robin. Hi, Jeremy. Hello, Alice.
And Alice Stewart is the one Bill is talking about there, Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. Hi, Robin. Hi, Bill.
Okay. So, Bill, let me start with you. What do the top three Democrats, at least in New Hampshire, Sanders, Buttigieg, and Klobuchar, need to do now to show that they can win in places like Nevada and South Carolina, which have much more diverse electorates?
They got to get to work and they got to round up a lot more votes. They have to raise a lot more money. And they have to appeal to a broader audience, for sure. You know, to state the obvious, it was a really good night for Bernie Sanders, for Pete Buttigieg, for Amy Klobuchar. But I think before anybody pops a champagne, right, or jumps off a cliff, I think it's important to stand back and realize that, yes, Bernie won in New Hampshire. But Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar together got a lot more votes than he did. So you can say the end of the moderates showed their strength as well as progressive Bernie. And the other thing is, as Elizabeth Warren pointed out last night, we're two states down, two red states, two mostly white states, two states that Democrats are not necessarily going to win. There are 55 states and territories to go, a lot more diverse, a lot more challenging. And then there's Michael Bloomberg hanging out there. So
right.
I think it's just starting to get wild. Mm-hmm. And anybody who tells you they know who the Democratic nominee is today is lying.
But do
Nobody
you think
–
I know we're only two states down. But do you think that Joe Biden, for example, can go through the next 2 weeks until South Carolina – I mean assuming that he doesn't win in Nevada, maybe he will
right. –
and really get through that with all the attention that is going to be paid to the other candidates and people starting to think, well, they might be the president. Is he going to be able to go through all the way for another couple of weeks without a win?
Put it this way, I would not count him out. Mm-hmm. In this year, I would not count him out. I think he has a lot of strength. There are a lot of people that love him because of his record, his experience, and the fact that they see him as a more stable maybe challenger to Donald Trump. But it depends a lot on his donor base. He needs the gas to be able to run through Nevada and South Carolina.
Okay. Well, Bill, first of all, Democrats in New Hampshire would say we're a purple state. But Alice, just to you, because both Klobuchar and Buttigieg are saying they can draw support from Republicans and independents. Now, we met a lot of Republicans in New Hampshire looking for a candidate that was not Donald Trump. Again, New Hampshire, a little purple. These might be old school Republicans, not at all the Trump base. But do you think that's going to be a factor, the fact that they can offer people outside the Democratic Party, they are saying they can, a candidate?
It certainly is an argument they can make. They are more moderate. They certainly have shown they have the ability to connect with voters and are a contrast from what we're seeing with regard to the direction of the Democratic Party. There's no denying that Sanders' performance in New Hampshire has painted a picture that his progressive policies are part of the Democratic Party's mainstream ideology, at least for now. I do expect mm-hmm. that to change because a lot of what we're hearing and the polls are indicating is that Democratic Party, while they have a large voice on the progressive side, they also have a strong voice on the moderate side, mm-hmm. hence the strong performance of Buttigieg and Klobuchar. Yesterday was a big victory for Sanders and for Buttigieg and Klobuchar. It was a huge wake-up call for Joe Biden. He needs to really scramble and get his act together in South Carolina. And I view it as a circling the drain moment for Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, dear.
She really has run out of steam. But the important thing to keep in mind, these first four early states between Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, that only makes up 4% of the total delegates needed. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at it from this aspect, but we're still at the very beginning stages of a very long process.
Boy, circling the drain, what an image there. But let's listen to a little of Elizabeth Warren from last night.
Senator Sanders and Mayor Buttigieg had strong nights. And I also want to congratulate my friend and colleague, Amy Klobuchar, for showing just how wrong the pundits can be when they count a woman out.
And so, Bill, you know, there she's being very, very dignified and gracious there. But as you both have been saying, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and Biden supporters are more than the Warren and Sanders combined. And it seems that within the Warren-Sanders camp, Democrats are choosing Sanders. Where do you see Elizabeth Warren going?
Well, first, I do think that the challenge inside the Democratic Party is the same as it was when this whole process began, which is, if you will, the more progressive versus the moderate progressive. Because, I mean, Buttigieg and Klobuchar are hardly or Biden are hardly conservative, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And but in that Elizabeth Warren's first then challenge was in the more progressive lane to beat Bernie Sanders. There's only room for one person in that lane. Mm. It looked like she had done it at one point, but she has not now, and I don't think she can recover. I think there's a very graceful speech last night. She's a good candidate, but I don't think she's going to make it.
Mm. Let's talk about the candidate who was not competing in either of the first two states, Michael Bloomberg, who's been spending a ton of money on ads, especially in those Super Tuesday states that'll happen at the beginning of March. And I think it's something like 40% of the delegates are going to be given out on that day. But Bloomberg was in the headlines yesterday because of some audio that surfaced of him defending the controversial stop and frisk policy, police tactics that he expanded in New York City. Here's some of that sound.
People say, oh, my God, you are arresting kids for marijuana. They're all minorities. Yes, that's true. Why? Because we put all the cops in the minority neighborhoods. Yes, that's true. Why do we do it? Because that's where all the crime is.
If you can't hear that, he's saying, why do we put all the cops in the minority neighborhoods? Because that's where all the crime is. Alice, President Trump tweeted this out. He called Bloomberg a racist. We should point out that, of course, President Trump has been accused of being a racist and also supports stop and frisk policing. But what did you think of this? And do you think this is going to hurt Bloomberg?
This is what you call an October surprise in February. And this was an effective way to put him on his heels when he has the wind at his back right now. Look, his position I didn't support. I think it was an inaccurate thing to say. He has come out. He's owned up to it. He's apologized, and he's asking people to move on. What we're seeing the last few days, he has really made a strong effort to reach out to the African-American community. He is receiving endorsements. I'm seeing you go online and social media, you're seeing a lot of black leaders and organizations getting behind him. He's making a conscious effort. I expect this to be a 1 or 2 day story and move on with regard to the audio tape. But he is gaining strength in these Super Tuesday states where he's put a lot of effort. And in Arkansas, even my former state, he's doing well. His problem is not going to be as much with the African Americans. He has a problem connecting with rural voters. That's what I'm hearing across these states where there's a large electorate of rural voters. He needs to fine tune his message on what he can do for those voters.
We just have a couple minutes here. I want to make sure that we get to, I'm sorry, Bill, but I want to make sure we get to something that some would say is a February surprise. There are calls now to investigate the sentencing of Roger Stone. This is the friend of President Trump who was convicted as a result of the Russia investigation of lying to Congress, obstruction. Yesterday, Trump tweeted that the 7 to 9 year prison term that was recommended by the federal prosecutors was unjust. Shortly after, Attorney General Barr did another filing, intervened, overrode that recommendation. They're asking for a lesser sentence, and four prosecutors resigned. Of course, the Justice Department saying that had nothing to do with the tweet. But Alice, you tweeted out, speaking of tweets, that the DOJ needs to lock up Roger Stone and throw away the key, full stop. Was it appropriate then for President Trump to seemingly ask his attorney general and then tweeting again today congratulating him for intervening in this?
It's really important to let the Justice Department do their job. And anyone who tries to intervene in the process, I think, is making a mistake. Look, Roger Stone was found guilty by all counts by the jury, and it's important to let the justice system play out. I cannot think of anyone more deserving of seeing justice served than Roger Stone. So I would like to see everyone sit back and let this judge make the important ruling. Look, he could receive up to 20 years based on the judicial guidelines. So I think that it's the judge's decision to make and no one else's.
Bill.
Can I just jump
in?
I just have to say, I think this is so outrageous on the part of Bill Barr. He has destroyed, not just here, but even previously, this just adds to it, destroyed the integrity and the independence of the Justice Department. I think he's our worst attorney general since John Mitchell, and he sees himself as just a toady of Donald Trump. Donald Trump tweets, and Bill Barr jumps in and tries to reverse the work of career prosecutors in the Justice Department. I think anybody who reveres the rule of law ought to be very concerned about what Bill Barr and Donald Trump together are up to.
Democrat Bill Press and Republican Alice Stewart, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, guys.
To be continued.
When it's too cold to go out or too icy to make it out of the driveway, where do you go to find just the right movie, just the right book, just the right show to binge? Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR can help you keep warm and keep up at the same time. Join us twice a week on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
President Trump heads into the general election with some deals under his belt. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which is an updated version of NAFTA that was signed into law last month, and phase one of the China trade deal, which was agreed to in December. But also a number of deals that the president has pulled out of, the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris climate agreement. So how has the president, who wrote a book in 1987 called The Art of the Deal, been as a dealmaker? Joining us now is Anne Geren, Washington Post White House reporter. Anne, welcome. And let's start with trade and the USMCA. How different is it from NAFTA, which President Trump has called the worst deal ever?
Well, it's not very different. It is a needed refresh of a deal that was written before a whole lot of technological advances, primary among them the fact that all kinds of orders and commerce can be done completely electronically now. That just simply wasn't the case when NAFTA was written. There needed to be a little bit of an update to it. But in terms of the really important idea that these are three countries working together to have a fairly open common market across the continent, that's not different. And the concessions that Trump likes to say that he got from Mexico primarily, but also some from Canada, are not anywhere near as large as he likes to make them sound, although there are a few.
What does the process tell you about his ability to make deals? Because if we think back over the last couple of years since he first started this process of reforming NAFTA, it's gotten pretty nasty between the U.S. and both Mexico and Canada.
Right. I mean, I think the USMCA is a good example of a couple of things. One is that the end result is really almost always less than promised or less than it appeared at the start. The second is that everything always takes longer than anybody thinks it's going to. Donald Trump certainly is not the first president to have had that experience, that trade negotiations can drag on for what seems like forever. But this one really did drag on a long time. And that wasn't entirely his fault. By the time it actually got done, then it got caught in politics on Capitol Hill and it waited some more. But the end result is that something that he talked about being able to do slam bam in his first year, super important priority, took until straight into the last year of his first elected term to finally get done.
Well, and speaking of trade deals taking a long time, let's talk about China. You know, we just got phase one of a trade deal with China. Of course, that has also come with a lot of consternation between the two countries and a lot of tariffs between the two countries. And many are questioning whether this deal is all that good for the United States. What do you think?
There are a couple of things that are important to remember about this deal. First of all, when the administration calls it a phase one deal, that is a big clue to the fact that the omnibus deal that would address really, really hard problems with China in intellectual property, in currency manipulation, in basically the fundamental difference in the structures between the two countries where there are state-subsidized businesses in China and there are not in the United States. An omnibus trade deal was supposed to reckon with all of those things. It simply wasn't feasible, certainly not in Trump's first term. The Chinese have had their eyes on the clock for a couple of years now on this, essentially waiting the president out. His leverage was diminishing. Everyone wanted to get an initial carve-out done. So they bit off some of the easier things and made an agreement that allows, frankly, both sides, but mostly President Trump, to claim a victory. And then, you know, were this to go on, and a lot of that will depend on Trump's re-election chances this year, then presumably we would move into actually harder negotiations from here to begin to address the rest of those issues. And well, I'll say one more thing about his negotiating style and how the China deal reflects it. You know, he calls himself the king of tariffs and is unapologetic in his belief that they actually work, and they worked particularly well in this case. His claim that it is China that's paying the brunt of this and not American consumers and American farmers has been widely debunked. Trump repeats it anyway and is likely to make it the fact that he got the Chinese to agree to buy more agricultural and manufacturing products as part of this phase one deal gives him a new lease on that argument going into re-election.
Well, and when you talk about the farmers, it should be pointed out that the bailout that the Trump administration had to give American farmers as a result of the trade war with China is probably going to cost U.S. taxpayers more than the auto bailout and may never be paid back. Worth pointing that out. You mentioned something a second ago that his leverage was diminishing. What do you mean by that as the trade war stretched on with China? Why did the leverage of President Trump diminish?
Because he wanted it more than they did. And that was pretty apparent.
It's not just trade deals that President Trump has been trying to make throughout his presidency. He's also been trying to make peace in various places, including Afghanistan. And he had planned to meet with both the Afghan government and the Taliban at Camp David in September, then called off those meetings at the last minute in a series of tweets. What do you think about that kind of deal making, having the Taliban invited to Camp David, which upset a lot of people, and then pulling out at the last minute and throwing the whole peace process in flux?
Yeah, that was a mess. And talks are back underway, but they lost a lot of ground. I do, however, think that the president deserves credit for being willing to do things in an unorthodox way when it comes to dealing with bad actors. He has not hung up on the idea that we don't talk to terrorists like George W. Bush was. And it really hamstrung their efforts to deal with multiple conflicts and problems around the world. If you're never going to get in the same room as somebody who has blood on their hands, you're going to have a hard time making peace because those are the people making the war. Trump has, because he is essentially without ideology, he doesn't come from that same strain of the Republican Party, he does take a fresh look at this. His lack of experience and his impulsivity tend to work in the opposite direction and make a mess of things. So far, he's gotten a couple things. There is a more or less moratorium on long-range missile testing in North Korea and nuclear testing. We'll see whether that holds. The North Koreans are not happy. I don't feel like they've gotten enough for that moratorium. But, you know, that's something. And it does owe to Trump's willingness to deal with Kim Jong-un in a direct and respectful way that Kim was looking for.
Although the critics would say that the problem with that approach is that the president of the United States has given Kim Jong-un propaganda material of these meetings that he's had with him, and it elevates the stature of Kim.
It absolutely does. And Trump essentially shrugs that off. The other thing that that approach does that the president can be rightly criticized for is that it leaves aside entirely the whole rest of the very long list of complaints we have about these groups and regimes on human rights grounds and many others. I mean, you know, Iran is an excellent example of that. North Korea is another.
President Trump has certainly been successful at pulling the U.S. out of deals. He pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. He pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Is he, would you say, better at blowing up deals than making new ones?
So far, yeah. He's got, in terms of high-profile deals, he's left more than he's made. Their argument there is primarily that the United States is being taken advantage of, and you know the rest of the world has for too long had the idea that the U.S. will just pay for everything and shoulder all the rough tasks in the world. It's a simplistic and reductionist view, but it is not entirely wrong, and it certainly resonates with a lot of voters.
And Gary, let me finally come back around to domestic deal making. And of course, he has had a very bad relationship with the Democrats in Washington, but he has been able to make some deals. I'm thinking of the prison reform bill that was a big deal that was made across party lines.
Yeah, absolutely. Criminal justice reform is one that there has been genuine bipartisan support. He likes making deals. He likes having everybody over to the White House and signing these things. It seems hard, if not impossible, that there would be another big bipartisan piece of legislation this year, but it is possible. But for sure, if Trump is reelected, I think that he'll try. Most second-term presidents do.
So you're a journalist. I'm not going to ask you to rate his deal-making skills, but what do the experts say about how good he is at actually making deals?
I wrote a story about this not too long ago, and most experts I talked to said he thinks he's a better negotiator than he is. He often actually has some pretty good ideas, but his track record is poor in actually closing the deal. Now, that was before USMCA and phase one of the China deal had actually crossed the line. But until those and until a couple other things that happened at the end of last year, as of like last fall, he had nothing. He had no full deal to his name for nearly 3 years in office at that point. These things do take time. Sometimes they happen all at once, as appeared to have happened in the last several months. But his track record is still many, many more things talked about, offered, promised than actually delivered.
That is Ann Gearin, a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Ann, thanks so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
President Trump's budget out this week isn't going anywhere right now, given the Democratic control of the House of Representatives, but it does give you a sense of his priorities, especially if he wins a second term. And those priorities do not favor greener forms of transportation like public transit and trains. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, here and now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, let's start with the most famous train line in the country, I would say, and that is Amtrak, the nation's rail service, which reported a record number of passengers last year, more than 32 million. We spoke with the CEO on this show, and he projected positive earnings for Amtrak this year for the first time ever. So why are cuts being proposed, or what kind of cuts are being proposed?
Big ones, Jeremy. $1 billion skewed more toward the long-haul routes, as you and I have discussed before on the show, are the ones that really lose a lot of money. But cuts also in the Northeast Corridor, the routes between New York and Boston, New York and Washington, and so forth, which are more viable. Worth noting, by the way, Jeremy, that those long-haul routes, which the administration noted are the ones that are less viable, those are the ones that run through rural America, what you might call red state America, his core support. So kind of like there's some surprises with the budget overall, right? The administration willing to tolerate headlines about cuts to entitlements like Medicare and Social Security that are popular among senior voters. This, too, willing to take that chance with some of their core supporters.
And when you look at the other cuts the administration is proposing for transportation spending, what stands out?
Cutting money also across the board, all kinds of things, including airport improvements, for example, being slashed by $400 million if they were to get what they wanted.
And public transit as well.
Absolutely. That's on the chopping block to pretty much everything, with the exception of roads and bridges overall. Now there, even there, a lot of they're sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul. There are cuts to some of those kinds of things. But on a net basis, no question, what you said before, sort of those greener forms of transportation are the ones that, no matter how you measure it, are taking the biggest hit.
So in terms of what the administration does want to spend money on in transportation, what's in there?
Yeah, so it's talking about $1 trillion over 10 years for, yeah, mostly roads and bridges, things that tend to benefit automobiles. Now, not all of that would be new spending. I mean, the government would spend a certain amount of money on all of that anyway, but that would be a big increase, and it would also extend the time. Normally, this would be 5 years at a time. They'd be committing to 10 years of big spending, and that would, even despite what would have been spent anyway, be in fact, a big increase, and for a longer period of time.
Seth, when you look at this budget proposal from the Trump administration and then combine it with some of the other places where even Democrats are in charge, California's Democratic governor just paused the high-speed train being built from Southern California to the Bay Area over cost concerns. Are advocates of trains and public transit losing the fight in the big picture?
Kind of hard to paint with a very broad brush. I mean, in California, what happened is that the public was all for the idea of a high-speed train, but it just ended up costing so much more than anybody had imagined. Mm-hmm. There are localities like Nashville that voted against an expansion of transit despite some progressive instincts, but others like Phoenix that voted in favor of expanding their public transit system. So a mixed record for sure.
That is Here Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The number of American troops who suffered traumatic brain injuries, TBIs, when Iran attacked their airbase in Iraq last month continues to rise. In its fifth reassessment, the Pentagon says the total is now 109, with an additional 45 diagnosed. You remember that President Trump downplayed these injuries shortly after the Iran strike.
No, I heard that they had headaches and a couple of other things, but I would say, and I can report, it is not very serious.
Well, this week, Trump told Fox Business that he started to hear, after he said that, about people having trauma, and it does exist, but he also said, I viewed it a little differently than most, and I won't be changing my mind on that. Paul Rykoff founded Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He hosts the podcast Angry Americans. And Paul, your thoughts about this number continuing to rise?
Well, it's very, very troubling. I mean, this is one of two things, Robin. Either it's incompetence or it's a cover-up. And either one of those things is deeply troubling when it comes to the health and well-being of America's sons and daughters in harm's way. I mean, we had an address to the nation where the president said no one was injured. Then it went up to 50, then it went up to 64, now it's up over 100. And I think it really cuts to the core of whether or not we can trust our president, our Department of Defense, and our government to tell us what's happening to our sons and daughters in harm's way. I mean, beyond that, it's obviously very, very serious when someone's got a traumatic brain injury. But I think as a starting point, the transparency or their lack of, or the just inability to quantify our wounded is deeply troubling and really unprecedented. I mean, this goes back to misinformation about casualties in Vietnam. And I think it really cuts to the core of our democracy in a very deep way that's bigger than just our military.
Yeah, all experts on TBIs, combat-related brain injuries, say that all of them, all brain injuries are serious, although the good news is that a huge percentage of people who are diagnosed early on and managed and cared for will fully recover. But you've expressed surprise at the high number who have these injuries, and we should say 27 of those diagnosed were transported from Iraq to U.S. medical facilities in Germany, and from there, 21 were transported from Germany to the U.S. for treatment. So obviously some serious injuries found there. And what are you hearing from veterans?
They're really bothered by this. I mean, we've worked hard over the last few decades to educate the public, to educate people in government. You know, the Department of Defense has spent billions of dollars trying to combat traumatic brain injuries and roadside bombs, IEDs, improvised explosive devices. These are really the signature injuries of the post-9/11 wars. So this could impact hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people who've served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and around the world since 9/11. So just imagine if it's your husband or daughter. Imagine imagine if it's your kid over there who has been told they just have, you know, a minor brain injury. If they got evacuated or not, this is very serious, and some of the signs may not show up for years to come.
Yeah, it also illustrates that at least 100 troops were kind of sitting ducks on that base, and were, you know, Iran was far more effective in its attack than we might have known.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I was on cable news the night of, and people were speculating all over the place about, you know, what the intention here is, and whether or not the Iranians were accurate or whether they were trying to miss us. I think the important point for people to understand is our troops are in harm's way all the time. And the deeply troubling part of the last few years is that the White House and the Pentagon continue to withhold information, and they continue to push the American public further away from our folks in conflict. Hopefully this will come up on the presidential campaign. Hopefully the candidates will talk about this and talk about how they would approach increasing transparency around the Department of Defense and our issues of war. There's nothing more important than sending men and women to die in war or to be wounded. So we think it really transcends all the politics of the day that are in the news.
It's Paul Rykoff, served in the Iraq War, founded Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and now hosts the podcast Angry Americans. Paul, thank you.
Thank you, Robin, as always.
Well, and now a story about an animal that inhabits the cold waters off New England's coast. Scientists think corals found in the Atlantic may hold valuable secrets for fighting climate change and saving coral in tropical waters. Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scahill reports on the Northern Star Coral.
At a lab run by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Milford, I'm looking at something strange. Tiny pieces of brown and white coral. Little animals that look like pitted rocks pulled from an alien planet, but are actually invertebrates, and ones that seem to be thriving in an odd place, the cold water off of Connecticut's coast.
The coral that exists in Connecticut is called Astrangia poikilata.
That's Sean Grace, a biologist at Southern Connecticut State University. He says that name, Astrangia, captures the surprise scientists felt when they observed this coral centuries ago.
So you can imagine back then, they pulled it up and looked at it and went, well, that's a strange thing to see off the coast of, you know, New Jersey, mid-Atlantic.
Today, this species of Astrangia, also known as the Northern Star Coral, is dispersed widely. From southern New England, it goes down the eastern seaboard into the Gulf of Mexico. Corals create important ecosystems, preventing coastal erosion and providing habitat for thousands of creatures. Many have a symbiotic relationship with algae called zooxanthellae. It's what makes tropical corals so colorful. When corals lose that algae, they can die. But Grace says for Astrangia, that's not the case.
When you find a coral that's become white, it's called bleached. And yet, in New England, we have this coral species that exists with and without zooxanthellae, and it does fine.
It's one of Astrangia's many mysteries. And Grace and NOAA scientist David Ballou are looking for more. Ballou stands next to an array of test bays, gesturing to a labyrinth of nearby pipes that connect with Long Island Sound.
The seawater comes in. We've got them at 18 degrees Celsius.
That's 64 degrees Fahrenheit.
This is raw seawater going through these.
Scientists bubble in carbon dioxide. In the sky, CO2 traps heat, raising Earth's average temperature. In the ocean, it causes seawater to become more acidic, and that can damage coral skeletons. Grace tweaks the pH across the bays. The idea is to simulate possible future ocean chemistry.
These are the most basic studies that we can start with. But if we go from this and we look at the responses that these corals have, okay, we can then start looking at their genes.
And in those genes, Grace says, is a playbook that might explain how this coral survives without algae or withstands the cold of New England's water.
And maybe put those in tropical corals or grow those into tropical corals where they become more resistant to environmental factors that might affect them.
We leave the lab and drive a few miles to a nearby beach. The plan is to collect colonies of Astrangia, which will get sent to Penn State for genetic testing.
Sound like Darth Vader.
In a parking lot, former student Gabriella DePreta puts on her diving gear. She's getting ready to go underwater with Grace. She remembers the first time she saw Astrangia on a dive in Narragansett Bay.
And we descended down, and I just saw so many hundreds of white and brown colonies everywhere. And it really intrigued my interest because I, as many other people in New England and around the U.S., don't even know that we have coral up here, right, because of these cold temperatures.
The pair slosh into the murky ocean, disappearing beneath the water's surface. On the shore, I watch as a buoy tethered to the diver slowly circles an offshore rock. Nearly an hour later, Grace comes back, breathless and apologetic. He lost his dive bag.
But we got some, so good enough.
Good enough for genetic testing, he says. Grace pours out the small handful of coral. It's been raining and it's cold, and we want to get inside and warm up. But for a moment, we share this strange sight, a hardy coral resting before us on a cold New England beach, which may harbor secrets that will save tropical corals hundreds of miles away. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
And we have a sad passing to note. Lyle Mays, the gifted pianist whose notes danced around guitarist Pat Metheny's in the 1980s in the storied Pat Metheny Group, has died of an undisclosed illness. Lyle grew up in Wisconsin. His sprawling technique perfectly matched Pat's soaring Missouri point of view. They co-wrote much of the music. This song is September 15th, before going on to solo careers. Lyle Mays was just 66. He leaves family and many broken-hearted fans who hoped one day to hear them play together again.
American Airlines has suspended direct flights to China and Hong Kong now through the end of April amid the COVID-19 epidemic. That's a month longer than previously announced. Delta and United have also suspended flights from major U.S. hubs to China as the disease continues to spread. More than 1,100 people have died so far out of more than 44,000 confirmed cases. The vast majority of those cases are in China. Now, one reason flights have been canceled is because of pressure from the airline's employees, pilots, and flight attendants. And for more now, we're joined by Sarah Nelson, who's international president of the Association of Flight Attendants and a United Airlines flight attendant since 1996. She's in Chicago. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, and United became the first airline to suspend flights to China last month. What role did your union play in that decision?
We actually have been working with the airlines in the best way possible on this communicable disease issue, this latest threat. So we had been talking with the airlines about minimizing the risk here for quite some time, and we worked with them on making sure that there's enough supplies on the plane for universal precautions. But at a certain point, the risk factor became too high, and we had very serious discussions about halting the flights, minimizing the impact of the potential exposure of spreading the virus.
Can flight attendants decline assignments on certain routes if you're worried for your own safety?
One of the first things that we did was get the airlines, specifically United Airlines, to agree to allow crews to make that assessment for themselves and to be able to refuse flights without discipline. Now, that didn't necessarily mean a pay protection, but they were able to make that choice for themselves.
Have a lot of them done that? Or before the flights were canceled, did a lot of them do that?
There were some who were making that decision not to fly. That did happen. But this moved relatively quickly, and the flight suspensions began around the same time that those numbers were starting to increase.
Are you concerned about domestic flights as well? Because somebody at this point could still take one of the flights on one of the, let's say, Asian carriers that are still operating between Asia and the United States and then get on a plane in the U.S. with a cough or something like that. Are there concerns about that?
What I would say is that the airlines are doing a very good job of tracking the potential exposure of any passengers. And there is an effort to determine who has come from the infected region and how that is attached to their travel record. And so there is a really quite good accounting each day of the potential exposure to people who have maybe come in contact with the virus. And that number lessens actually by the day because of the numbers of flights that are being pulled down really around the world.
What kind of precautions are flight attendants taking now to avoid getting sick in this outbreak?
This is a good reminder. You know, this flu season has actually been very difficult. And so we really encourage the traveling public not to fly if you're sick. We encourage our members, flight attendants, not to fly if they are sick. We negotiate in our contracts protections so that people can take that sick leave when they need it. It's an issue at an airline like Delta Airlines, where there's not a contract and not a union. Of course, there are all of the precautions like regular hand washing, using the universal precaution kits on board, which would include gloves and masks and germicidal disinfectant, skin wipes. It's also about making sure that you're covering up cuts and you're not touching your face. You're not touching any place where you can be directly exposing yourself, and being very aware to be on the lookout for potential symptoms and taking the steps on board to try to isolate any passengers who may be experiencing some of those symptoms.
Now, we don't have official numbers from the airlines about how much money they're losing because they've had to suspend all these flights to and from China. But are you concerned about the impact on the industry because of this virus, and that maybe job cuts would follow?
It is always concerning when you have a communicable disease outbreak that is at risk of becoming a pandemic, and that always has an impact on the airlines. We absolutely are concerned about this. And this is one of the reasons that we were so vocal right at the start to say, get a handle on this. Airlines can do a lot to help stop the spread of a communicable disease. They are taking a huge hit by having to cancel these flights to China. And it's really concerning when you have members of the government, like Commerce Secretary Ross's comments that the coronavirus could boost U.S. jobs. That was just both dubious and on the merits an insult to working families who know very well from past experience with SARS and MERS and the pull down of flights and how that can actually affect our jobs. And also millions without healthcare coverage or with bad plans that have to weigh the cost of seeking care against the possibility of a massive hospital bill if they or their family members fall ill. So when you have senior members of this administration making comments like that, it is very concerning when we're saying that this government needs to be coming together and have a coordinated response to this and have a really thoughtful and measured approach. And it's just really out of touch with working people on the front lines.
That is Sarah Nelson, who is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
The champions, best in the world.
America's Got Talent champion Shin Lim went on to win the world competition. So what is it about this magician that so intrigues? We'll talk to him next time, Here and Now.